From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The UN Security Council will vote to choose the next UN Secretary General today. We'll talk about why the U.S. is alone in opposing Boutros Boutros-Ghali. The U.S. probably won't send troops to Zaire, but in a rare interview, we speak with a former Special Forces Master Sergeant about his experiences in such missions from Somalia to Haiti.
The thing that I noticed didn't have anything to do with the execution of foreign policy or missions or anything. It had more to do with the composition of the forces that I was working with, and that was with the Ranger Battalions and with the Counterterrorist Joint Task Force and with Special Forces. And what I noticed was, again, that this was the last bastion of white male supremacy. The level of racism in these units is just unbelievable. It's indescribable.
And still unequal, the shameful truth about women and justice in America. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Rwandan government said today that there are hardly any refugees left in the South Kivu region of Zaire, so there is no longer any need for a planned Canadian-led multinational peace force. The Pentagon is saying the United States has tentatively decided not to send troops to Zaire and will instead provide military cargo planes to help fly humanitarian aid to the refugees streaming home to Rwanda. This news in the United States, it's our fault. That's what a new study says about cancer deaths. A report being released today says 65% of cancer deaths are caused by things people have control over. The Harvard School of Public Health study estimates that 30% of the deaths are caused by smoking and the use of tobacco, 30% by diet and obesity, and 5% by lack of exercise. Meanwhile, lawyers for a Hong Kong-based former British-American tobacco company executive argued in U.S. District Court Monday their client should not be extradited on bribery charges because he would face possible execution when the British colony returns to China on July 1st. Liu Qinhong, a former commercial director of British American Tobacco in Hong Kong, is accused of accepting about $3 million in cash bribes and $1.5 million in unsecured loans to ensure the supply of cigarettes to a distributor. Arafat, Tito, Gorbachev, and now Castro. Sooner or later, revolutionaries and communist leaders show up on the Pope's doorstep. Today, it was Cuban leader Fidel Castro who met with Pope John Paul II for 35 minutes at the Vatican in a historic encounter between alumni of the Cold War. And this news from the front page of the New York Times today, it says, in the final days of the campaign, the White House withheld major details of discussions between President Clinton and a prominent Indonesian family, despite recommendations for fuller disclosure by the two lawyers on the White House team that was created to handle such sensitive political inquiries. This according to administration officials. As Mr. Clinton's comfortable lead was eroding in the polls, his conversations with members of the Riotti family, which became a centerpiece of Bob Dole's attack on Clinton, were characterized vaguely as social calls. Reporters and Republican congressional investigators were not informed that the president had discussed policy toward China and Indonesia with James Riotti, the Indonesian billionaire who is at the heart of the controversy over the role of foreign money in American politics, as Mr. Clinton acknowledged in an interview last Friday. And also this news from Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. Indonesia's Supreme Court has reimposed a 4-year sentence on independent labor leader Mukhtar Pakpahan for inciting workers to riot in 1994. This, according to newspaper reports today, lawyers and friends close to Pakpahan were unable to confirm the reports. They said they had not been officially notified of the decision. Longtime listeners of Democracy Now! May remember that the day he was arrested, Mukhtar Pakpahan, we did an interview with him. And this news from Mexico. Mexican rebel leader Subcomandante Marcos warned yesterday that the Mexican government must decide whether it wants peace or war with his Zapatista guerrillas. Amid music and dancing to celebrate the 13th anniversary of the Indian movement in this remote jungle village of La Realidad, Marcos said it was up to the government to get derailed peace talks with the rebels back on track. He told hundreds of mostly impoverished Mayan Indians, "Today the government must choose between death and life. If it chooses war, we are ready. If it chooses peace, we are also ready." Chinese activists, in a statement today, hours ahead of a visit by the U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher, protested against the American backing for Japan's bid to become a permanent member of the U.N. Security Council. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Today, the United Nations Security Council will vote to choose the next U.N. Secretary General. Boutros Boutros-Ghali wants a second term, and 14 of the 15 U.N. Security Council members support his bid. But the United States stands alone in opposing him. U.S. Ambassador Madeleine Albright says she's received written instructions from Secretary of State Warren Christopher to veto Boutros-Ghali because the U.S. Congress has lost confidence in the Egyptian diplomat. Joining us now to talk about the struggle over leadership in the U.N. is Pacifica's United Nations analyst, Phyllis Bennis, who is also with the Institute for Policy Studies based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Phyllis.
Thanks very much, Amy.
Well, what do you make of this controversy over Boutros-Ghali? What is it all about?
Well, I think it's easier in a certain way to look at what it's not all about. There was an interesting notion in the Washington Post article this morning that described Boutros-Ghali as, quote, the symbol of everything that congressional conservatives dislike about the United Nations. On a certain level, that's really true, because you have a situation where he represents the third world. He's an African. He's an Arab. He's not white. And he talks back to the United States. Now, what he does not represent is actual resistance to the so-called reform campaign that the U.S. has been waging for the last several years. He has implemented every one of the slash-and-burn budget cuts that the U.S. has demanded. He has laid off almost 10%. I should qualify that. He has arranged for there to be an almost 10% reduction in jobs through a variety of means just at U.N. headquarters. The problem for the U.S. is that he talks back when he does it. He doesn't do it with a complacency. He doesn't do it diplomatically. He has, on occasion, accused the Security Council, for example, of paying more attention to what he called the war of the rich in Bosnia than to the turmoil that was raging in Somalia. This was, of course, several years ago. So you have someone who was represented ostensibly as the Secretary General coming from Africa. It was the Africa group who endorsed him, although it's been clear that many of the African countries and others in the Global South are not particularly happy with Boutros-Ghali, particularly because he has implemented those kinds of dramatic cuts in the UN's ability to provide various kinds of economic and social programs and services. But he has antagonized the West, and particularly the U.S., even more by his attitude, his seeming refusal to accept direct jurisdiction, if you will, by the United States government.
Even though he does a lot of their bidding.
He does exactly what they want, but he makes it a little tougher on them than they would like. What I think is true about what the Washington Post said this morning is that Boutros-Ghali is appropriately seen as a symbol of the entire United Nations. The Security Council is only one part of the UN. The Secretary General really does personify, and should, that's probably appropriate, the view of the world of what the United Nations should represent. The notion, however, that somehow Congress sees him as this major stumbling block towards paying the U.S. debt to the United Nations, which is now over $1.6 billion, is really nonsense. First of all, that debt began accruing way before Boutros-Ghali was ever even considered to be a possible future Secretary General, let alone before his actual selection. And it's clear that the White House has been no more favorable towards Boutros-Ghali than Congress. The idea that somehow if there were a different Secretary General, that Congress would magically begin paying off this back debt, I think is really fancy thinking.
Do you think, Phyllis, that no matter who was the Secretary General during this presidential contest year, that person would have come under attack? The Republicans use it as a way to go after anything that in any way suggests the usurpation of sovereignty of the United States. And Boutros-Ghali also has a name. You know, I think of Pat Buchanan, who used to love to dwell on names that he wanted to emphasize as being of ethnicities and backgrounds other than his. But even Boutros-Ghali himself, what he represented, that he represents internationalism, and that anyone would have represented this in this year, And with Clinton caving on everything, he also caved on this.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. We see a situation where the Secretary General of the United Nations was such an attractive target for the Clinton campaign. It was clear that the timing of the announcement, which was made in an unprecedentedly early period, in early September, unheard of in UN diplomacy, and in an unheard of manner by announcing it first to the New York Times rather than by raising it anywhere within the United Nations first, we have the Clinton campaign obviously afraid that Dole was about to launch a major attack on Clinton for allegedly being soft on the United Nations. So what does Clinton do? He does an end run around Dole to say, we can be tougher on the UN than you can. We're going to announce months before the election is even planned that we will veto the current Secretary General and we will do anything necessary to prevent this evil man from getting a second term. Well, wait a minute. Where did that come from? I mean, this had nothing to do with the actual progress of diplomacy at the United Nations. This was clearly an electoral ploy. And it was precisely for that reason, it was understood to be an electoral ploy, that other countries understandably took the view that this was one more time when Clinton was going to have a lot of fuss and bother about an issue and later back down on it. There was a lot of assumption going on at the UN that after the election, there would be some willingness to compromise. And in fact, I think if there had not been so much speculation about what would be the consequences for Clinton, who already is troubled by his view as a waffler on so many issues, what would be the consequences for him if he did soften his stance on Boutros Ghali, I think there probably would have been a change in policy to at least a two-year compromise, allow a face-saving withdrawal, a short second term for the Secretary General. The U.S. could save face by saying, well, we think there should be a change, but it doesn't have to be quite so immediate. But because there was so much attention paid to the speculation at the United Nations and elsewhere, both in internationally and in U.S. domestic politics, about what it would mean for Clinton to do that. As a result of that, I think that we are less likely to see that kind of a compromise. I don't think it's impossible, but particularly with the British position being one that seems much more amenable to supporting the U.S. position than they did earlier, I think that we are less likely to see the possibility of a U.S. compromise. As it stands right now in the Council, it appears that the vote will be 14-1 in favor of Boutros Ghali, and the U.S. will cast the veto. But the British diplomatic circles, particularly Sir John Weston, the British ambassador, has made clear that they are prepared already to essentially abandon Boutros Ghali. In that circumstance, I think the pressure on the U.S. to make some sort of a compromise to avoid antagonizing all of its allies is substantially less than it would have been.
We're talking to Phyllis Bennis, who works at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. What about all of the international conferences that have taken place? You had the Women's Conference in Cairo, the Environment Conference in Rio, the Housing Conference in Istanbul, Human Rights Conference in Vienna, and now, most recently, just this weekend, the International Food Summit that just concluded in Rome, where the U.S. said it does not support the right of everyone to have food. Were these clearly some were planned before Boutros Ghali became U.N. Secretary General, but are these part of the animosity toward him?
Well, they're a very small part. The conferences are troubling for United States policymakers and their generalized anti-UN biases because they are so public. And it flies in the face of the real reason the United Nations chooses to have these conferences outside of UN headquarters to make them into very high-profile media events. It's precisely to call the world's attention to these very pressing issues of women's rights, of human rights, of food accessibility, of social rights, all of the other, the environmental conferences, all of those kinds of issues that so often get unheard in the world's press, even when they are being discussed at the United Nations, suddenly come to the center of the world's agenda when they are held at a conference somewhere else, where the press corps as well as the diplomats have to pack up and go somewhere. Somehow that seems to work to get a lot of attention. So the opposition from the U.S. Comes from that reality. The U.S. does not want and is not willing to sign on to binding commitments for internationally approved treaties on things like, as you say, the right to sufficient food for life. It's horrifying for, I think, people in this country to realize that our own government, the wealthiest and most powerful government in the world, is saying, no, we don't think that everyone should have a right to enough food to eat, that it's somehow okay for children to be starving around the world. We don't want some other outside agency like the United Nations telling us what to do. This is a travesty. And if it happened, as it so often does, in a closed-door meeting at UN headquarters, no one would hear about it. When it happens in Rome, when a lot of reporters have gone to Rome, their editors are making sure to get the story out because they've paid all this money to get them to Rome, that makes a difference. It means that that word gets out. So I think there is greater antagonism because of the United Nations conferences, because of the degree of their success in putting those issues on the agenda. It's not because of the conferences themselves, the notion that the conferences waste money. Well, sure, that happens all the time. The UN wastes money in small ways like any other large bureaucracy. But the notion that somehow that's the problem is really nonsense. The U.S. hates those conferences precisely because it shines the media spotlight on issues that it would much rather keep its own position very quiet.
Phyllis Bennis, let's talk about the possibilities of replacements during the second term.
Well, this is a very interesting possibility. I spoke on Friday with a representative of the Embassy of Ghana, who is widely believed to have informally put forward the name of Kofi Annan, who is a citizen of Ghana and is currently the UN's peacekeeping chief. In my view, he is probably the front runner of the current short list of African candidates for the next Secretary General if Boutros Ghali is not chosen. I think there will also be the possibility for others. Ironically, the U.S. went out of its way early on. Madeleine Albright, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, actually told the press that the U.S. would even be willing to accept Salim Salim as the next Secretary General, who is, of course, the current head of the Organization of African Unity. He became the centerpiece of U.S. opposition to the United Nations in the 1970s and through the period of 1981 when the new Secretary General at that time was being chosen, because he had been the main champion as head of the non-aligned group at the UN of China's admission to the United Nations. And he was so excited when the vote finally happened in 1974 that the Chinese had been admitted that he danced in the aisles of the General Assembly.
He did a jig.
And this was, to U.S. views, this made him absolutely persona non grata. And the U.S. has routinely vetoed his the possibility of his becoming Secretary General. He's now back on the short list, as are several other African diplomats. But I think the head of the short list right now is Kofi Annan. One of the ironies, of course, is that the issue of gender has come up finally at the United Nations. But the problem is that the women who are being proposed, other than Sagato Ogata, the current head of the UN High Commission for Refugees, who is from Japan and has made clear that she will not take the job at this time, all of the other women are Europeans. And as a result, it would really undermine the right of Africa to have one of its own for two terms. Unfortunately, there have been no African women proposed as serious candidates, which is a very unfortunate thing, because this would be, of course, with all of the discussion about gender and lack of gender balance at the United Nations in high positions, this would be the perfect time. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case, but at least it's been put on the agenda so that next time around, it's certainly likely that there will be many more serious women candidates put forward.
Let me ask, we only have a minute, but why bother having this UN Security Council vote if the U.S. can veto it? We know what the U.S. stance is, so we know no matter what, even that 14 out of the 15 countries are against what the U.S. is doing, it will
prevail. The reason is that before the decision can be made, there has to be a vote. And the other countries are not willing to let the U.S. off the hook and let it do it quietly. It wants a public showing that the U.S. is isolated on this. Ironically, if any of the other veto-wielding countries, whether China or France or one of the others, took a stance that it would veto any other candidate other than Boutros Ghali, you would then have a very interesting possibility where the Security Council could be declared to be in deadlock, and at that point the General Assembly could assert itself and choose its own nominee to be the next Secretary General without having a recommendation from the Security Council. And of course, in the General Assembly, the U.S. does not have a veto. So theoretically, Boutros Ghali could be chosen again in the General Assembly in the context of a deadlocked council with the U.S. voting to veto Boutros Ghali, China or France perhaps voting to veto any other candidate. It could make for a very interesting situation over the next couple of days.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, we want to thank you for joining us, and we'll certainly follow the situation. Phyllis Bennis at the Institute for Policy Studies, also a Pacifica correspondent, and author of Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. You're listening to Democracy Now! Later in the show, we'll talk about the shameful truth about women in Justice America. But up next, we're going to take a look at, well, in a rare interview, a conversation with a retired Special Forces Master Sergeant. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. The United States has tentatively decided not to send troops to Zaire, and instead will provide military cargo planes to help distribute food and supplies to Rwandan refugees. Last week, President Clinton agreed to send 1,000 U.S. troops to Goma as part of a U.N. security force. But since Rwandan Hutu refugees began streaming back home, Pentagon officials say a military intervention is no longer necessary. At the onset of his second term, President Clinton is still developing a Clinton doctrine, a guiding policy around sending U.S. troops abroad, often into countries whose conflicts don't threaten U.S. interests. It's a rare opportunity to speak with someone who's been involved on the ground in a number of U.S. military actions, especially if they're not a spokesperson. Stan Goff is a retired Special Forces Master Sergeant who's been in the military for more than a quarter of a century. He served in Somalia, Peru, El Salvador, Guatemala, Vietnam, Panama, Haiti, among other countries. The U.S. military pulled him out of Haiti because he was working too closely with Lavalas, the democratic movement of Haiti. He even had the nerve to arrest some members of FRAP, the right-wing terror group, which had covert U.S. support. Well, this weekend, Juan Gonzalez and I, Juan, of course, the columnist with the New York Daily News, got a chance to speak with Stan. It's the first time he's speaking publicly under his own name. And we talked, in light of what's going on in Zaire, about his missions. And we began with Somalia and asked him to tell us about what he did there.
Well, yeah, it's really important to understand that my participation in Somalia was short-term. It was designed to be short-term. And it was a direct action mission to capture Mohamed Farah Aidid. It had nothing to do with the overall, well, it had something to do, but it only tangentially had anything to do with the overall mission, which was initially stated, and that was to provide humanitarian relief. And of course, a series of events, first with the killing of the Pakistanis by the Aidid forces in South Mogadishu, and then the subsequent retaliation by the U.S. military in which a number of civilians were killed. It caused a lot of animosity between the forces, and the forces in and around South Mogadishu then went into a far more martial posture than they had been in before, and of course things escalated over a period of months, and they determined that a direct action force was going to be necessary, and that was the Ranger Task Force, and that was what I was part of, and I was the senior medic at that time with I was on loan from the Special Forces community to the Ranger Regiment as a Special Forces medical sergeant. It's really hard for me to say anything intelligent about the overall mission because I didn't participate in the whole mission. I was never involved in a lot of the briefings about the whole mission, and I wasn't that closely in touch with the evolution of the overall mission in Somalia. I can only speak to the actual DA mission, which everyone knows now had fairly catastrophic consequences.
Can you describe what those consequences were?
Well, I mean, the consequences that everyone saw, you know, two helicopters were shot down, and the task force was caught in the middle of town by a very substantial militia force. They were widely outnumbered and basically encircled when they went to rescue the downed helicopters, and what ensued was about a 10-hour firefight. I was not in country when that happened. I had already left the country, but I had participated in earlier raids that were based on the same operational template as that particular operation. And I mean, you know, people make mistakes, and there were a lot of mistakes made. And I'm not sure that it's... it's my role to be an armchair quarterback about that or anything. You know, that's sort of a whole nother discussion from what political objectives are behind a lot of these operations. And I'm not really sure what was behind that operation because just a matter of weeks later, we were chauffeuring Mr. ID'd around an American aircraft and trying to negotiate some kind of a peace. I think it's fairly obvious that we overreached ourselves, and I think, as has happened in the past, that there was probably a gross underestimation of the capabilities of the Somalis in this case, and you know, in other cases in the past. I mean, that's just that's a military reality that occurs and reoccurs. I'm not sure that it's really central to any discussion about my overall experience in the military because it was...
Well, Stan, one of the things that interests me in reading some of the articles that you've written about your experience is obviously special forces go into a country based on a certain level of intelligence that they've received from American intelligence agencies about who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, what is the character of the population, support or opposition of a particular figure. Mm-hmm. To what degree do you think that the kind of intelligence that you were getting was objective intelligence or was intelligence that seemed to some degree or other propping up one political side or another?
Well, that sort of depends on where in particular we're talking about. I mean, if you're talking about doing a humanitarian civic action mission someplace like Venezuela, obviously there's not much of a political agenda to predicate the intelligence that's going to go into an operation like that upon. Where in a situation like Haiti, there was obviously, and with new developments, if people are keeping up with it, it's very obvious that there was a powerful political agenda that was behind most of the major policy and the tactical decisions that were made on the ground with reference to the military operation there. And in a case like that, as was the case in Vietnam. The intelligence, there are a lot of things that can impact on intelligence, but preconceptions impact very heavily on intelligence. I mean, if people have already decided who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, then obviously their present, the language they use, and because we receive these intelligence summaries in narrative form, and you know, we all know, or y'all know as journalists, that the way you present that narrative can determine how that narrative is received, and there was a very strong, in Haiti, for instance, a very strong anti-Aristide sentiment on the part of most of the military commanders, and I think probably most of the people in the U.S. government. I think their support of Father Aristide was politically expedient. But I mean, there's no doubt that behind the scenes they forced him to step down before he took a second term. So, you know, I think.
Well, I recall being in Haiti a couple of days after the coup against President Aristide and filing a story to one of my editors. And most of the press, I think, at that point, who had spent any time in Haiti, knew the level of support that Aristide had among the general population. Mm-hmm. Suddenly my national editor says to me, well, you know, Juan, the Washington Post and New York Times have just come out with this leaked report, this leak about how Aristide is crazy. And instantly it was sort of like, you can't go too far. You know, almost all the rest of us in the press were told, listen, this is coming from the Washington Post and the New York Times, and it's a leaked CIA report. And it sort of put the brakes on a lot of the other reporters who did not want to appear, despite what they saw themselves, did not want to appear based on this new information to go overboard in the way they were reporting Aristide's support. I'm just wondering what in the military, what the, occasionally in these hotspot areas, to what degree do special forces, who are clearly soldiers more well-trained and more trained to act independently, what credence do they give to some of these intelligence reports?
They give the credence that their own preconceptions. You know, don't get me wrong. The Special Forces is still one of the last bastions of white male supremacy in the Army and in the military in general. And so you see a distinct difference in an attitude that's taken toward a place like Haiti for which very little is known. Most folks are just colossally ignorant about Haiti, including in Special Forces. Where their long experience and a higher degree of cultural recognition in other places, say in Latin America, the Caribbean, causes Special Forces people to more quickly assimilate into that culture and more readily establish rapport with the indigenous population. Where in Haiti, most of the experience that any of the folks in Special Forces had prior to the intervention was working in the camps in Guantanamo Bay as interpreters and whatnot. And that situation did not do anything positive for subsequent relations between Special Forces people and Haitians, because they were in basically a concentration camp situation. And so there was sort of a natural animosity that developed. And there's a racial component to that, too. I mean, people don't like to talk about that, but that factors in very heavily in U.S. relations with Haiti throughout history.
We're talking to Stan Goff, retired Special Forces Master Sergeant. And Stan, why don't we talk about this issue of race? Instead of talking about the specific places you've been, tomorrow we are going to address some of those areas from Guatemala to El Salvador to Peru. I wanted to talk about the issue of race in the military, the issue of race in the Special Forces.
The thing that I noticed didn't have anything to do with execution of foreign policy or missions or anything. It had more to do with the composition of the forces that I was working with, and that was with the Ranger Battalions and with the Counterterrorist Joint Task Force and with Special Forces. And what I noticed was again that this was the last bastion of white male supremacy. The level of racism in these units is just unbelievable. It's indescribable, and it's carefully managed and kept internal. And people, you know, the commanders are very careful to make sure that there's no appearance of official racism. But I'm just talking about the attitude of the majority of the people who are involved in these units. Is very racist.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because you spent time at Fort Bragg, and certainly we've been hearing a lot of reports about Klan activity at Fort Bragg, and even the Canadian forces not wanting to send their military down there to train because of what's going on there. There were even hearings in Congress where the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy were, where they were talking about the rise of right-wing militia activity even within the military. What about your experiences around Klan activity, and why is it that the Special Forces are so white?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons for that, and I don't think that I ever had any direct contact with Klan activity. Certainly, I had a lot of contact with people that just sat around and spouted off one racist thing after another, and certainly I went through a system that would have been much more difficult for me to get through the selection and assessment process in any one of these special operations units had I not been white. It can be done very subtly, because as you go through Ranger School or you go through Special Forces Qualification Course or you go through any of these courses, Many of the evaluations are very subjective, and so there's an opportunity for the people who are running these courses to act as gatekeepers and to keep the force pure. And that's on people's minds, and I've heard people say that that's on their minds and that they made sure that they, you know, they kept their unit white and things like that. I remember when I was in Fort Lewis in 1979, 1980, when those folks were killed on camera by Klansmen in Greensboro, North Carolina. Members of the unit were saying that's a wonderful thing, you know, it's a great thing that they went out there and killed those communists. And it's like, these are American citizens who were having a peaceful demonstration, and these guys jumped out and shot them dead in the middle of the street on camera and got away with it. And it was just that attitude. How that happens, like I say, there's just any number of reasons, and not just the policy of exclusion, but I think there's a lot of cultural factors that figure in there too. Most of these courses for selection and assessment to get into special operations have a very strong element of trying to break people down through humiliation and things like that, and it's like pledging to a fraternity in a lot of ways, only much more harsh. And you know, I don't think that black soldiers in the main really feel like that's such a big novelty, and they may not look at that's sort of a continuation of the same thing for them in a lot of cases. Why in the world would they want to go through that just to get into a unit where people don't want them around anyway? Then on the other hand, there's this business of a series of gatekeepers operating in these communities. Now, it's changing. It's changing. Excuse me. It's changing very, very slowly. But it is changing. There are more black soldiers in special forces now, far more than there are in, say, the Ranger Battalions or the counterterrorist forces. But it is slowly but surely changing. I mean, societal pressure is being brought to bear.
So how does that affect your missions? I mean, for the Rangers and the Special Forces, and well, now we're looking at the possibility of Zaire in Somalia, in Haiti, when you have these white racists who are moving into these places.
Well, it depends. You know, there's no way to point directly at how it can affect your operation, but one of the things that I fought against very, very hard whenever we went into Haiti, I had commanders who were saying, because they were so cognizant of force protection issues, that when I took my team into Fort Liberté, they wanted me to take a platoon of Rangers in there with me for force protection. And I was absolutely against that. And the reason was, I just felt like that group of people would probably be a little bit more trigger happy and a little bit more apt to cause an incident that would get out of hand and result in some sort of an awful tragedy. How does it figure in? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that people are really allowed to manifest. The military is still, and the thing about these units is they are very well-disciplined units. So if they're told not to do something, even though they may feel like doing it, and I'm not talking about the 82nd Airborne. That's considered a conventional unit by most special operations standard. I'm talking about Special Forces and the Rangers and folks like that. They're very disciplined. So if they're told to behave a certain way, even if they don't want to do it, more often than not, they will behave that way. But there's no way to take... My problem as the mission progressed in Haiti, one of my problems was that I had initially given a directive to everyone there to be as friendly as possible with all the people from Haiti and refrain from being rude and to wave at people when they waved and to smile until it hurt and things like that. And that was a very difficult directive to enforce as the mission progressed, you know, and as an element of... you know, the excitement started wearing off the mission, and it started out, you know, as sort of like compassion fatigue. And then a lot of the old racial preconceptions emerged. I had a fellow, we had a very strict policy in Haiti, not to give food to civilians because it would open up the floodgates. Once people perceived us as a feeding point, then we would create a situation which we would then have to control. And it's a situation that would create animosity among neighbors and whatnot. So we decided just to stay away from giving away food of any kind, which I think was a very sound policy. Now, having established that policy, I went out on the porch of the house that we were using as a team house in Fort Liberté one day and found one of my subordinates out there feeding MRE to a dog while a dozen Haitian children looked on. And it took me 15 minutes to explain to this man what was wrong with what he was doing, why that would hurt our relationship with the local population. It just didn't occur to him. The funny thing about racism is that it's a system where people have a way, a system of shortcut thinking in which they can fail to acknowledge the most basic humanity of someone else, you know, based on the color of their skin or whatever other component of ethnicity that they perceive. And especially if you have, you know, a cultural estrangement to add on to that, like you have in Haiti, which is essentially a West African culture, and there's very little cultural recognition between Americans and Haitians. So you asked earlier me questioning issues of race in the ranks of the military over the years probably led me more to where my thinking is now, even than the operations that I participated in. And that's probably a longer explanation than we have time for here.
Stan Goff, a retired Special Forces Master Sergeant who's been in many places, from Somalia to Haiti. And it is the first time that he is speaking publicly using his own name, since it is very rare that a person on the ground in the Special Forces talks about his experiences. We'll be playing more of that interview tomorrow. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. I'll be back in 60 seconds to talk about women and the justice system. Listening to Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Congresswomen said after questioning four generals yesterday that the Army appeared to be dealing effectively with a scandal in which drill sergeants have been accused of pressuring female recruits for sex. Rape is not part of the job, Congressmember Carolyn Maloney, a New York Democrat, said after the 90-minute closed-door meeting with the generals. She said, "This is the most serious peacetime scandal in the military that I can remember." But she and other congresswomen said the generals had convinced them that the Army was determined to find and punish drill sergeants who've harassed or had sex with female recruits and prevent such abuse in the future. They said the generals also agreed to consider their suggestions that a permanent telephone hotline and special Army Ombudsman office be set up so Army women can report sex harassment directly to higher officials. Now, clearly, crimes have been committed here, but a lot of those crimes also come out of a kind of attitude toward women, and that attitude toward women is pervasive. Today, we're going to look at another aspect of the U.S. government. We're going to take a look at the judiciary. Sexism is alive and well in the American justice system, and investigative journalist Lorraine Dusky has written a book to prove it. From law schools to law firms, sexual harassment to rape laws, from judicial bias to criminal justice, Dusky says women are still second-class citizens. Her new book is called Still Unequal: The Shameful Truth About Women and Justice in America. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lorraine.
Thank you. Well, after listening to him, I can see exactly what kind of problems we have in the entire country. His attitudes about racism are often the same about sexism is often the same kind of problem, but it goes more unrecognized in a sense than racism does.
Well, talk about what it is that you found when it comes to women in the justice system. What are the most egregious problems?
Well, one of the things that struck me right from the beginning, and was why I wrote the book when I started 4 years ago, was that it was so encompassing, so pervasive, that it ranges from a woman in Wisconsin who was being prosecuted for adultery during a custody battle. And, of course, her husband admitted that he was also an adulterer, but he had committed it across state lines because he was a trucker, and therefore he wasn't going to be prosecuted. What really surprised me was that it's just everywhere, and we don't recognize it except we hear one egregious case here, and it happens to somebody in Minnesota, and somebody in Wisconsin, and somebody in Florida. But it all seems individual. It all seems very separate. But when you look at it as a whole, you can see how widespread it is.
Well, let's go back, Lorraine, and talk about the history of women's place in our legal code.
Well, when the laws were first written, when they basically we have the English Code of Law, and when they were put down onto paper, they codified what had been practiced, but they also implemented it. They held women back. If nothing was written down, in a sense, you could have little forays going forward. But once it was said that moderate correction, or which is another word for domestic violence, was practiced among some groups and it was all right and it was permissible, and the Blackstone says it only occurred during the lower classes, you had sort of a blanket permission. It was okay to beat up your wife.
Let's talk about how the judiciary now deals with domestic violence and battered women.
Well, in some places, progress is being made. I just got done looking at Nashville and San Diego, where a comprehensive program to combat domestic murder was put into place. And they do that not simply by catching the murderer after the woman is dead, but by treating domestic violence very seriously. If the guy doesn't go to a very lengthy, often year-long program of anger management and why it's wrong to beat your woman or beat your girlfriend, he may end up in jail. He's on probation right away. The cops take it seriously there. They investigate the crimes just as they would any other crime. They take pictures of the phone that's ripped out of the wall, the furniture that's overturned. They talk to the neighbors. They use hospital and doctor reports. They talk to the children. But if you have policemen come to the home and then say, oh, well, it's just a family matter, and what happens in many cases is that the wife will strike back, and apparently more women are doing that now. And so when the cops get there, the man says, well, she hit me, and, you know, she started it or whatever. And the woman is still hysterical because she may have been beaten up 10 times by this guy who, in most cases, is going to be a great deal stronger than her. Often the police then arrest both people. Many communities have pro-arrest policies, but the policemen don't investigate to see what really has been happening, and both of the women end up arrested. There was just a story in the Washington Post the other day about how female arrests in domestic violence cases is greatly up. But then farther on in the story, it talked about the fact that both sexes are being arrested when the woman is just defending herself. Excuse me.
We're talking to Lorraine Dusky, and she's author of Still Unequal, The Shameful Truth About Women and Justice in America. And we should say that while crime in America is down, and that's been highly touted by the Clinton administration and everyone who wants to take credit for it, crime against women is not down. And that's extremely significant. What about judges themselves and women becoming lawyers and eventually becoming judges? How are women doing?
Well, women are going into law school in great numbers. Nearly 44% of all law school students now are women. But in law school and then later in the profession, at many places and at many law schools and many firms, they face really massive discrimination. And at the law schools that are the worst, and it's often the very best law schools, Harvard and Yale, among them, don't do very little to actually combat the attitudes that are prevalent in the classroom. The men, while they may have been perfectly good friends and peers in underclassroom classes, suddenly seem to, the women say, turn into different kind of characters often. And it may be because they sense that the woman now getting the professional degree is more of an economic threat. So then you go from law school to the profession, where in the biggest firms in America, the prejudice is just prevalent. The companies will make one woman a partner, and then they act as if all the work is done and nobody has to come behind them. And often these women don't open the door for other women behind them. They are so pleased at being the queen bee in this kind of a setting, or maybe there's two or three of them, that they don't really give a hand to the women behind them. And the women today who are becoming lawyers really don't have the same attitudes of the generation prior to them, who had the feeling that they could not have families. These women want to be lawyers and they want to be families, have families, but not enough, the law firms aren't changing enough to accommodate them when they in fact could, because in law you really work on a number of cases on a part-time basis, so you don't really have to work 90 hours a week the way the law firms are currently set up. So out of this group, though, is where you get our judges. Judges are almost always lawyers first, and it's not often just your sense of moral fairness and rectitude that makes you a judge. It's how good you are at playing the political system. So consequently, judges can be no better than the worst sexes in the law firms.
You know, I thought it was interesting in your chapter on sexual harassment in law firms, you talk about a survey Prentice Hall did of 553 female litigators and how extensively, really systematically, women are harassed in law firms, that nearly two-thirds of them report they've been sexually harassed. That means that two out of three female associates at small firms will be sexually harassed at the office.
Right. And at some firms, it seems like it's just a frat boy fraternity party constantly. One firm in New York, the women... I mean, basically, I talked to half a dozen women who had left the firm, women who were still there, and they were more or less at their wits' end. After Anita Hill, and after the Baker and McKenzie decision, in which a woman who worked for Baker and McKenzie for actually just 25 days was awarded a verdict of over $7 million, there was sexual harassment training was called for at many firms, but it often was one day. And the women that I talked to said that the worst harassers treated it as a joke, that they really didn't, it didn't make a dent. And the people who didn't need it, of course, treated it seriously. I think one of the most telling aspects of all this is that when there is a lawsuit, or when there is when someone is finally going to ask for a settlement instead of suing, or when for sexual harassment, when they go to meet the partners always know who the harasser is. But because law firms are set up as more or less democracies, and if a big rainmaker or someone who brings in a lot of money is a sexual harasser, no one wants to tell him that he's out of line.
Let's talk quickly about some of the major issues. And I hate to do this so quickly, but divorce, sexual assault, and custody, and where women stand, starting with divorce.
Well, one of the worst things that's happening in divorce is that since alimony, or maintenance as it's now euphemistically called, has become something that judges don't like to award except for a very small length of time, homemakers who have devoted their life to, let's say 20, 30 years to taking care of the home, raising children, providing the hot meal for the guy who comes home late at night, or being his hostess and entertaining clients, they often end up on the really short end of the stick in divorce. They are not given the kind of benefits back that they gave to the marriage and made it possible for that man to have the career. So they're being hurt the most in divorce cases today. In custody, one of the most shocking findings that I came across was that men who batter are among the group most likely to sue for custody. But when you look at who is actually winning custody, you see no difference in the percentages between the batterers and the non-batterers. It seems that the men who batterers need to have control over the situation and the family and the wife, and they will sue for custody simply to maintain that control. And you go to court, and the guy puts on a good suit and a good smile, and tells a good game, talks a good game, while the woman on the other side of the room is hysterical because she knows what he's like. So the judge sees a semi-hysterical woman and a perfectly respectable man, and he seems to be the more friendly parent, the parent who will allow access to the children by the wife rather than the other way around. And so the man is likely to win custody.
What
in
about
sexual assault, every state but Utah now has rape laws, rape shield laws, so that you can't really besmirch the woman's character on the stand, or that's the intent. But lawyers find very tricky ways to get around them.
I just want to stop you for a second. Except Utah?
Yes.
In Utah, you can smear the woman.
Well, there's no law that says you can't. It's completely up to the judge. But what happens is that the lawyers find a way around it. They will ask a woman on the stand, when did you tell your boyfriend about the alleged sexual assault? And then she'll name a date. And then the lawyer says, well, was that before or after you were living with him? Implying, of course, that she's a slut in, how can we take her word for granted? She just doesn't want her boyfriend to know who she's living with, not in wedlock. That she was assaulted. The other thing, in one case in Kentucky, much was made over what the woman bought at the convenience store when she was raped in the parking lot. I mean, what difference does it make what she bought? Well, the lawyer was determined to inject into the courtroom record that she was buying disposable diapers. She was a single mother. She was not married. She had not been married. So it was another way of telling the jury that she's a slut.
How do they get away with this?
Judges don't stop them. There has been enough judicial training, and there's been enough. There have been enough lawyers, women lawyers, in court, and enough has been made over the fact that judges used to call lawyers, women lawyers, little lady or young miss or things like that, and really demean them. They know that they shouldn't do that, but they don't know that they need to rein in the lawyers. And the lawyers who will do anything to win don't understand that by belittling the woman, they are doing the same. They would not even think of doing this, for instance, if it was a racist issue. But somehow it's okay to make fun of the woman because, she's not well prepared. They'll imply, they'll throw their papers around, or they'll just look disgusted. They do all kinds of things to imply that she's not a good opponent, and yet they wouldn't do these things if it was an African American.
Lorraine,
in general,
how does the law view a man raping his wife?
Depends on the state. A couple of years ago in South Carolina, there was an audio tape of a woman and a videotape where she was bound and gagged and her tape was over her mouth. And after it happened and when she escaped, she ran naked to the neighbors asking for help. This man was acquitted. What was not brought into court was the fact that there were several, he had a prior history of domestic violence, and that the jury never knew about it. I mean, so juries have a whole different view than the law. And Delaware has one of the most archaic laws on the books. If you are assaulted by someone you are the voluntary companion of, it's a lesser crime. That means that if I go on a first date with somebody and he rapes me, it's a lesser crime than if he met me in a dark alley. It also is a lesser crime if I have had sex with the man in the previous 12 months. So, therefore, it's very hard in Delaware to get good convictions on cases that in other parts of the country would seem slam dunks.
And acquaintance rape?
Well, acquaintance rape is sort of the hot button in rape cases today because the question of consent, the man says, I thought it was all right. And the woman says, of course, I didn't think it was all right. So you still have a scattershot approach in some more liberal jurisdictions or where they go after these cases with more vigor. In New York, where we have Linda Fairstein heading a sex crimes unit, she can get some convictions in some pretty cases that she wouldn't have had, you wouldn't see occurring that way 10, 15, 20 years earlier. But in other parts of the country, the women don't even bring the cases because they know it's impossible. The difference between, let's say, a small town in Pennsylvania and a large urban area is phenomenal.
Lorraine Dusky, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Lorraine Dusky's new book is called Still Unequal, The Shameful Truth About Women and Justice in America. It's published by Crown Books. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin and Dan Coughlin, our engineer, Errol Maitland, with help in Washington from Kenneth Mason, our director, Brother Shine. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Or to make a comment, you can call our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Minutes, 15 seconds. Universal time, 14 hours, 59 minutes.